Tonight's topic is forests and forecasts, the effects of trees on climate change. Now, for me personally, this is of interest because I'm a graduate of the NC State School of Forestry, and I'm also a resident of the planet Earth, as you know, so this topic is important to me. It seems I have been witnessing conflicting reports on whether massive reforestation and forest protection can really help with reducing CO2 levels in the atmosphere. I don't know if you've seen those same reports. So some of the questions that come up are, what roles do trees actually play in the carbon cycle? Can trees help with the worries of climate change? And do trees hold promise as a renewable energy source? So tonight we have two speakers that are going to help answer some of these questions. Dennis Hazel is an extension specialist with NC State University Department of Forestry and Environmental Resources, where his responsibilities include forest health, productivity, and tree production, Christmas tree production. He's worked extensively the last 3 years on woody biomass-based renewable energy and serves on the board of directors of North Carolina Green Power. He and I apparently were in grad school together at the same time, so that'll date him and date me. John King is an assistant professor in the Department of Forestry and Environmental Resources at NC State. His research focuses on the productivity and biochemical responses of forest vegetation to changing environmental conditions. He received his PhD in forest ecophysiology from the Department of Botany and his Master's of Science in Tropical Forest Ecology from the School of the Environment, both at Duke University. So you'll give them a warm welcome. And Dennis Hazel and John King.
Yeah, that mic should work. Well, you'll have this mic.
And oh, okay.
This mic should be turned on too. You might test it.
Yep.
I've got to ask, who's your biofuels person that's coming?
No. John Bonnet and Mark Reifers.
Okay. They'll do a good job.
Well, we appreciate the invitation and are flattered that you come to hear us speak. Dennis and I worked together at NC State in the Department of Forestry and Environmental Resources, and we discussed briefly what we were going to do tonight, but we by no way planned it out very carefully or rehearsed it. So
it'll be evident.
Yeah. So I think what we'll do is I'll start it off with a general introduction to the carbon cycle and the role of trees in the carbon cycle. Talk about broad issues of climate change and that kind of thing, and then Dennis will give his contribution, and then we'll just open up for questions. I gave Katie a handout to pass out. If you don't have one, raise your hand, and she will get one to you. They're on your tables. Okay, and the cover sheet, of course, is this very nice poster that they put together for this event. If you look at the first page, shows a graph. The top part panel of that graph shows the atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration over about the last 1,000 years. You see it's on the bottom axis is year 1,000 to 2,000. And you can see that the concentration of CO2 was stable at about 280 parts per billion until about the year 1850. And that signifies the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when we started burning fossil fuels in a big way as a society. And you can see the resulting effect on the CO2 concentration right about that same period. It started going up very rapidly. And so did other atmospheric constituents like methane, nitrous oxide, and others. If you look on the right-hand axis, that's the global warming potential, or the radiative forcing. That's in watts per meter squared. And you can see that we've increased the radiative forcing capacity of the atmosphere by about 1.5 watts per meter squared. And to put that in perspective, the solar constant in terms of energy that's impinging on the surface of the atmosphere, the top of the atmosphere, is about 360 watts per meter squared every second. Okay, so we've increased that by 1 watt per meter squared, basically by increasing the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. So hence the warming effect that we all hear about. If we look at page 2, look at the bottom graph. Again, these are data from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and this is from the 2001 report. And what that is a temperature reconstruction for, again, the last 1,000 years, from AD 1000 to AD 2000, from ice core bubbles and tree rings and other sources, coral reefs and other sources. And what you can see is the temperature mean relative to the 1961 to 1990 mean was basically below that 1961 to 1990 mean for the entire 1,000-year period. And then about 1850, lo and behold, started to rise very rapidly. Okay, and this is one of the major pieces of evidence that leads people to believe that the rise in CO2 is linked to the rise in the global temperature and changing climate. Another piece is another major piece of evidence is the performance of what we call global circulation models. And I don't have that data in here, but we can discuss it if anybody's interested. So we have this kind of temperature record data that tells us that things are changing. We have anecdotal data as well. The picture on the upper left-hand panel is a picture of Lake Superior that I downloaded from the web on January 7th of this year. I used to live on Lake Superior in one of my former lives. I was teaching at a university up there. In the 30s, you know, I used to go fishing with these old miners, and they used to tell me that in the 30s, Lake Superior used to freeze so solid that you could drive vehicles on there and go ice fishing and all that kind of thing. This is a picture from this year, and Lake Superior does not freeze anymore. So very obvious differences in the climate that are observable over the human lifespan. The right picture is a cover of a Bioscience magazine, and that shows, that shrubs are encroaching in the Arctic, and there's been a wide documentation of many other biotic changes, changes in bird distributions, changes in plant phenology. Things are flowering earlier and dropping their leaves later, and all kinds of changes in the natural world that indicate that ecosystems are responding to the change in climate. If you turn, now getting into trees, if you go to the next page and we look at the graph of the Mauna Loa record, this is the instrumental record of atmospheric CO2 concentration that was collected starting in the 1950s, the late 1950s, primarily for meteorological reasons by Charles Keeling and Associates. And what you can see there is, this graph starts in about 1957. I was born in 1962, so you can see when I was born, the atmospheric concentration was about 350 parts per million. Now that I'm getting, on in years and the ripe old age of 45, we're at about 380 parts per million CO2 concentration. So even in my lifetime, the concentration has increased incredibly much. And again, this is undisputably due to human activities and combustion of fossil fuels. And whether that's linked to climate change or not, this is still a huge perturbation to a natural biogeochemical cycle, which affects plants and all kinds of things. So we are definitely having an impact on the planet in major, major ways. How many people have seen this graph before? Probably it's been published in the popular media. So you can see the monotonic rise, and actually the disturbing thing is that the rise in CO2 concentration in the last 10 years has been the fastest that it's ever been in the last 150 years. The economies of China and India and other countries are starting to ramp up, and they are based on fossil fuels. And so we're actually increasing the concentration of CO2 faster than any time in the past. As our awareness grows of the effects of CO2, we're still increasing it even that much more faster now. So that's the rise. Can anybody guess what that sawtooth pattern is due to? So people, that's due to the seasons, the oscillation of winter and summer. In the summer, the warm season, you have photosynthesis occurring that pulls CO2 into the plants, pulls the atmospheric concentration down a few parts per million, and then the next winter, plants shut off, basically, and the concentration rises back up. Down at the bottom, we get at that mechanism a little bit closer. That's a cross-sectional diagram of a leaf, and you can see on the underside of the leaf, there's the stomata, the holes, the pores in the bottom of the leaf. The plant opens those pores to allow CO2 to enter in to the interior, what we call the intercellular space, airspace, and then the water, the CO2 is dissolved in a film of water on those mesophyll cells, and then goes through the biochemical steps of photosynthesis and is fixed as sugars and eventually into wood. So this is, this is the direct link between plants and CO2. Basically, photosynthesis is a substrate for CO2 is the substrate for photosynthesis, and it's what these chairs are made out of, and our homes and everything. So it's a very direct link. If we look at forest in terms of the global carbon cycle, that's the cartoon on the next page. And this was published by a friend of mine, Kevin Griffin, in 1996. And what you can see here is, I don't want you to memorize the whole chart, and there won't be a quiz after dinner, unlike my class. But I just want to give you an idea of the relative magnitude of the different pools and what we call the fluxes in the global carbon cycle. If you look in the atmosphere, you can see there are 750 gigatons of carbon. That's 1 times 10 to the 9 tons, metric tons of carbon in the atmosphere. And then if you look at the tree, there's about 610 gigatons of carbon in terrestrial vegetation. So there's about, you know, on the same order of magnitude of carbon in vegetation as there is in the atmosphere. Plants take up 100 gigatons of carbon per year through photosynthesis. And then they release roughly 50 through respiration. And then another 50 is released through soil respiration. That's respiration from roots and soil microbial communities. So, and basically, plants are in balance with the atmosphere. Deforestation, you can see, is releasing 1.6 gigatons of carbon per year to the atmosphere. And if you look at the little truck on the left-hand side in the factory, our fossil fuel combustion, you know, this budget was put together in 96. It's about 6 gigatons now per year. And if you go back up to the clouds and you look at that plus 3.2, that's the amount that is actually increasing in the atmosphere every year. So of the 750 gigatons of carbon in the atmosphere, we're increasing that by 3.2 per year. And notice that that's about half of what we're actually emitting. So a big question in global change science is, where is that other half of the carbon that we're emitting going? Some people think that it might be going into the ocean through physicochemical diffusion, and other people think that it might actually be going into the terrestrial biosphere through to forest ecosystems through what we would call CO2 fertilization. Because CO2 is the substrate for photosynthesis, you could reason that if you give plants more of it, they will be happier, and in general, that is true. Greenhouse operators have known for a long time if they increase the CO2 concentration in their greenhouse, their poinsettias look better, and you know their plants look nice and healthy, and that's part of the reason that the plants look so good at the greenhouse, and then you get them home and they start crapping out. So this is the global carbon cycle. We can come back to this if anybody has any questions, but I just wanted to put into perspective how trees fit in with it. One last point is if you look at the soils and detritus, 1,580 gigatons of carbon in soils. So actually soils have 2 to 3 times as much carbon in them as do the plants. And the soil and the carbon gets in the soil through the plants. The plants produce leaves and roots that turn over on a yearly time step. And so every year, you know, when the leaves fall and you have to rake up your yard, if you didn't rake up your yard, that material would decompose and eventually contribute to soil carbon, which is the largest and actually the longest live pool of carbon in terrestrial ecosystems. So if CO2 is influencing the way forests grow through CO2 fertilization, we need to know about it so we can actually better parameterize our global carbon budgets and have a better idea of what we're actually doing and how forests are responding. If you go to the next page, this is the top is just a composite satellite imagery from NASA from the mid-90s. And really, I just put this on here. You have color copies so you can see the dark green areas are primarily the areas of the Earth where forests occur. So you can see, you know, there's a big patch in the Amazon Basin, the Congo Basin in Central Africa, tropical Southeast Asia, Eastern North America, boreal latitudes in Canada, and significantly in Northern Europe and Central Asia. So big forest bands. And again, if you wanted to see how that carbon was distributed, I put a table below that, which tells you basically which kind of ecosystems contain how much carbon. And again, we won't go through that in detail here. If you take one of my classes, we will. But really, generally, the trend is where it's warm and wet, you have the highest productivity. And so the most biomass carbon is going to be contained in biomass around the tropics, the moist tropics. And as you head towards the equator or towards the poles, productivity declines, so the amount of biomass carbon declines. But what also declines is the rate of soil carbon decomposition. And so they actually have more carbon in soils as you go to higher latitudes. So these things have a lot of importance when you think about how forests are managed. You know, we talk about tropical deforestation. Why is that important when we talk about climate change? Well, because they're the most productive ecosystems on the planet. And if we destroy those, then we're actually destroying one of the best carbon sinks we have. Okay. And likewise, if we warm up the planet too much, or if the planet warms up too much, a lot of the carbon that's locked up in soils in the high latitudes will start decomposing and actually be a positive feedback and really increase the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. So scientists like myself try to understand these various relationships between forest ecosystems and the environment. And one way we do that is this last page. It's called the Aspen Face Experiment. And I've been lucky to be involved with this experiment since 1997 when it started. It's still ongoing. It's funded by the Department of Energy. And this is basically the largest global change experiment in the world. And what you're looking at is an aerial photograph. And this is a of the site. It's about a 70-acre field. And in that field, we have 12 plots. Each of those circles is a plot, 30 meters in diameter. And within that 30-meter diameter space, we've planted communities of trembling aspen, sugar maple, and paper birch, which are the predominant species in the higher latitudes. And we've been able to suggest, with this advanced technology, it's sort of like the Duke Face site. If you've been to the Duke Face site, it's a similar type experiment. We're able to control the concentration of CO2 and ozone, actually, in that space, in that volume of air. And so these plants that have been growing since they were, 6 inches tall, have experienced atmospheric conditions that are predicted for the year 2050. And we've been studying it for 10 years now. It's gone through its early stages of stand development. And we're basically measuring everything you can think of to measure. Photosynthesis, respiration, plant biochemistry, water relations, productivity, development of the forest floor and soil carbon. And so, DOE is very interested in funding this kind of research because this will allow us to parameterize ecosystem models so that we can kind of get some predictive insight about how forests will respond to these changes that are occurring in the environment and hopefully come up with adaptive management strategies and hopefully constructive energy policy. So that's all I have for now.
For now. John was complaining about his advanced age. When I was born, they hadn't discovered carbon dioxide yet. So.
Yeah.
Well, as I was introduced, a major part of my appointment is in forestry extension. And what I do, or my specialty, is forest management or production forestry. So most of what I'm paid to do is to work with landowners who are trying to grow timber on their land and maybe also manage for wildlife and other amenities. So what in the world does this have to do with all of that stuff? And John and I were talking to Katie. We thought might be interesting to, with the two speakers, to bring what seem like some sort of disconnected ideas and maybe figure out how they come together sort of in the name of carbon and climate change. But what I'll do by way of some preliminary remarks is tell you of some things that are going on in the policy arena, which I've been working in renewable energy for about 3 years now and really pushing it a lot. And not so much from a technology point of view, although I do have active technological research going on a couple of conversion processes, but most of what I've been doing is in the area of policy, so it probably won't catch you by surprise, but there are some major initiatives in the state that are going to impact renewable energy and potentially impact carbon. That would be an ideal. One of them is the Renewable Energy Portfolio Standard. I imagine most of you, how many of you have heard of that? Probably nearly all of you. Well, your General Assembly passed that bit of legislation last August. It was the first such legislation in the southeastern United States. We have and have had for a good while a North Carolina Green Power program, and I hope if you're not a contributor to that you'll consider it. Voluntary program where you can donate some extra money with your utility bill, and the Green Power program takes those funds and adds to what the utilities are willing to pay for renewable energy brought into the grid. and it makes especially small renewable projects economically possible. So it's a real good program. But it only amounts to about half of 1% of our energy in the state. That's after 4 or 5 years of the program. So we're not doing much renewable power generation in the state in terms of electricity. So the renewable portfolio standard is different in that it requires the utilities, the public utilities and the rural electric co-ops and the municipalities that have their own power generation, it requires them to generate a portion or of their portfolio from renewable energy. So if you're a major utility, such as Duke or Progress, by the year 2020, you will have to generate a minimum of 7.5% of your power from renewable sources and potentially up to 12.5%. The other 5% can be met, requirement can be met either with energy efficiency measures or with renewable. And don't let it scare you, but it's thought in North Carolina about 70% of that portfolio will be met with wood. So that's a pretty major thing to think about. That's a lot of wood. We're talking about 8 million tons a year for which we'll be making electrons. So we can talk more about that. And where my group is actively working right now with both Duke and Progress and helping them get geared up for it. But that's a major initiative. Then, and I didn't bring this up here to recite from it, but thought you might find it interesting. Secretary Ross, our Secretary of Environment and Natural Resources, commissioned an 18-month project with about 50 of us to come up with a strategy for dealing with North Carolina's contribution to greenhouse gases. And that was the report that we just finished. It's pretty comprehensive. And it, to dovetail with what John was saying, if it were adopted fully, we would be establishing about 500,000 acres of new forest land in North Carolina for carbon. We would have a very extensive incentivized program for shade trees around homes. I won't go into details. Some conservation measures to encourage landowners to retain their land in forest land instead of converting it to Walmarts and subdivision. Some incentive programs for ethanol production and also some that are geared at the public utilities. So this doesn't deal just with wood, but that's a major part of it. So there's a lot going on in the state, and just starting next Monday, a week from yesterday, the Environmental Management Commission is now charged with, and you folks I'm sure will have an opportunity for public input, they are charged with the responsibility of taking a total look at what renewable energy in North Carolina will mean, both in terms of cultural impacts and in terms of environmental impacts. So that's a major process that's just getting ready to get underway. So a lot of initiatives, a whole lot of it has to do with wood and wood resources. As I was leaving home this morning, the last commercial I heard on the radio as I was leaving was Progress Energy. And they're good partners. They're aggressively going after this and seeking advice of the university. But I think it's fair to say they were not in favor of this renewable portfolio standard. But within weeks after it passed, their commercials started changing to Progress Energy, seeing energy in a new light. And two of the commercials that I heard today talked about meeting energy requirements through a combination of energy reduction measures and innovative renewable technologies, including solar, wind, and the last word was, sure enough, biomass. So it's happening, and North Carolina is really breaking ground in terms of the southeastern states, looking at renewable energy and carbon issues, and who knows how it's all going to shake out. But there's lots of other stuff that's going on, major biofuels initiative. A number of other scientists have developed, it's called a biomass roadmap that includes agricultural sources. So a little bit of what's going on in North Carolina. I think with that, we'll take questions. Who's got the mic?
Is it turned on? Okay. There you go. Number one.
Thanks. I have two questions, one to the person on the right and one on the left. One is about the trees and the biomass. If we wait till 2020 to start growing them, shouldn't you start growing them now so they're big and they accumulate faster? That's one question. And the second is, to be able to pull CO2 from the atmosphere, 4 or 5 years ago there was talk about tankers that while they were on the ocean they would dump low levels of iron and I think manganese. How effective is that, and is that really realistic, and can you expand on it?
Okay, I'll take the first question since it was directed to
sure.
me. And and with that, I'll ask you a question. So am I correct in saying that your assumption is going to be that we're going to produce this forest biomass by growing trees for energy? Fair assumption?
Since you guys are in the forestry department, I figured you'd...
It's obviously a loaded question, but...
Yeah, but I mean, there's jojoba and all the other things that grow, so I guess it could be bacterial biomass, too.
Well, that's true. We've got one faculty member working on duckweed, but the answer to the question is that the 8 million or so tons that we're talking about dialing up to, and I should say the renewable portfolio standard has a requirement that, as I've already sort of implied without stating, it increases every couple of years. It's stepped, gives the utilities time to sort of gear up technology, and they're used to calling up their favorite coal supplier and give me 3 train loads at plant number 8 next week, and now all of a sudden they're in the wood business. But most of the assumptions behind this portfolio standard is that it's logging residues that are going to be used for the biomass, not taking trees that are on the landscape now that would normally be destined for a higher value market, such as paper, lumber, saw timber, and the anticipated or forecast prices for energy wood are so low that unless demand was far more than what we forecast, you won't see traditional products go into, we won't be cutting down trees and burning them. So what we'll be doing is just simply doing a more efficient job of harvesting, and the stuff that's normally left on the landscape will be gleaned, chipped at the site where everything is sorted out, sent to an energy plant. So the dedicated energy crops is something that we expect will be coming down the road.
Sorry, okay, so the soil ecologists aren't here, but what does that do long term to the soil? And is bark mulch going to cost me $80 a bag?
It might not be $8 a bag, but it good chance your bark mulch will go up. And very good question on terms of site productivity. Our environmental NGOs are, as you might guess, are very much interested in how all of this is shaking out. They're engaged, and their two areas that they're principally interested in is how much gleaning can we do off the site without impairing long-term site productivity, and what about provision for wildlife, such as a lot of species are dependent upon coarse woody debris, slogging slash. So the answers for people looking at it, and there isn't any single number to answer the question, but it's a valid concern.
And also, I think as far as trees being able to bring down the CO2 concentration by the year 2020, I did hear Representative David Price speak, and he was referring to federal initiatives that stated we have to reduce emissions to specific targets by the year 2020. But I'm in agreement that we really should do everything we can now to get those emissions down, because there's going to be long-lasting effects, and we really can't wait another 12 years to start doing something. So anything we can do to increase the woody biomass across the landscape will help in that effect. To get to your other question about the iron fertilization of the oceans, that's still a viable hypothesis. It's still a hypothesis. People are they had done some experiments in the 90s with equivocal results, and there's a new set of experiments being conducted now. And so it's still the hypothesis is that the ocean phytoplankton are iron limited in the open ocean, and if we can basically fertilize them with iron dust, then that will decrease the limitation. They'll be able to photosynthesize more and pull a lot more CO2 out of the air. But I think it's best to characterize that as an operating hypothesis at this point.